This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
It's just hard to imagine that Lee Zeldin is apparently trying to move up the ranks towards the worst EPA administrator ever. And he's got tough competition in Scott Pruitt from Trump 1 and from Neil Gorsuch's mother from Reagan 1. They were two lawless, useless people, and Lee is vying for their record.
The Trump administration assaults science-based regulation, higher education, and American workers.
Even though AI is posed as your assistant, folks, you are training your replacement.
The use of artificial intelligence to train teachers threatens teachers, students, and the public.
They're trying to sell this this promise, this vision of AI will help humanity, will save humanity, will make the world a better place. We do not need a superintelligence to make the world a better place. All we need to do is be better humans today.
Community activists and workers in San Francisco protest the introduction of AI into the workplace and the power of tech baron Sam Altman, who runs OpenAI. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. I'm pleased to welcome back to Pacifica Radio Professor Adam Finkel, a doctor of sciences with expertise in the fields of occupational and environmental health and safety and risk management in those areas. We last spoke to him for CRD's June 2nd show, in which he spoke about such topics as solution-focused risk assessment, the efficacy of N95 respirator masks, as well as the contradictory missions and structures of the federal occupational and environmental regulatory agencies. He also decried and deplored the Trump administration's ramping up of a campaign against research and scientific policy agencies of the federal government. Thank you, Dr. Finkel, for speaking with me today.
Sure, I enjoyed it last time. I'm happy to come back.
Thank you. Indeed, Professor, you are aware that Trump's EPA under Administrator Lee Zeldin announced last Friday plans to eliminate its Office of Research and Development, with the justification given as cost-cutting. What are your thoughts on this in terms of the potential loss of research capacity and its impact on the American people, economy, and environment in the near and medium term?
So it's a family show, and I won't say what I really think about this, but it's unconscionable. We've known that the next 4 years are not going to provide any relief to the citizens and the workers of the country who are suffering from environmental damage. But it was not clear until recently that this group is determined to ruin it for the entire next generation, because bringing back an entire 1,200-person research arm of a big organization will be done when normal people return to power, but it will take years to get back on track. The EPA research arm is a world-class organization. It's been around since 1970. They've done incalculable amounts of high-quality research. And the thing to emphasize is that the research that EPA does supports science-based regulation or non-regulation. And if you're just groping with incomplete information and not having done the research, that's what opens up policy to either under-regulation or over-regulation, which is bad for business. So I think the business community, everybody's afraid to criticize fascist wannabe regime. So we're not hearing a lot of criticism from the business world, but they can't like this because research is to their benefit as well. It's just hard to imagine that Lee Zeldin is apparently trying to move up the ranks towards the worst EPA administrator ever. And he's got tough competition in Scott Pruitt from Trump 1 and from Neil Gorsuch's mother from Reagan 1. They were two lawless, useless people, and Lee is vying for their record. I think it's worse than conniving. I think the business community is unwilling to speak out, but they are not in favor of this. It is not going to save them money in the long run. It's not going to save the country money in the long run. The EPA research budget I haven't done the math, but it's probably a few dollars per American per year. And again, that money is spent not only to save human suffering and the cost that that burdens the economy with of people who are diseased or die before their time and are a burden on the healthcare system, but it costs business money when they don't have the benefit of high quality research that tells them not only how to make people healthier and safer, but a lot of the rules that EPA and OSHA have put out over the years, thanks to their research, has saved companies money.
I remember you used the example of the N95 mask that you said was about to become a standard and yet was nixed by and rejected by the Bush W. Bush administration for what reasons? I mean, was it just favorable to business or what exactly happened there?
Well, actually, it's more complicated. The OSHA tuberculosis rule that we had ready to go in 1999 was actually shelved by a Democrat after Robert Reich left the cabinet and my first boss, Joe Dear, left OSHA. Now, I had a new boss who had different priorities. He put the tuberculosis rule on hold. And then when Bush was elected, it wasn't going to go anywhere anyway. But we would have had a stockpile of hundreds of millions of N95s ready to go for COVID 5 years ago had that rule passed in the late 90s, and we would have saved a lot of lives from infectious TB. It was a combination of my boss, but also the American Medical Association, the hospital associations. The doctors do not like to be told anything about their field, but none of them know anything about industrial hygiene or aerosol chemistry or the physics of respirators. And I'm involved now with a group of people. We are trying to begin the discussion about phasing out the surgical mask, these very cheap face coverings that don't do any good for patients or doctors. They're not designed for infection control at all. And if the companies would just stop making them and make the N95s instead, which are marginally more expensive, we would actually have much less infectious disease in hospitals.
Thank you for that. I'd like to ask you about regulatory capture, by which is meant the control by private businesses that are subject to government regulatory oversight of these very same regulatory agencies. This happens through a variety of means that include lobbying, campaign contributions, the so-called revolving door of people moving between industry and regulatory positions. Obviously, the defense industries and department are front and center there. It also could be due to contradictory missions held by many government agencies and departments who are tasked, for example, the Department of Agriculture with promoting American agriculture. At the same time, they're supposed to protect the public and workers from negative impacts of agricultural operations, including food poisonings, etc. What are your thoughts on this theory, and have you actually witnessed any of this in the fields in which you work?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you something in a minute about something going on at the state level. But at the federal level, we see this all the time. There are a lot of books about this. I just reminded myself of one from 2014 that I enjoyed very much by Daniel Carpenter and David Moss called Preventing Regulatory Capture. One of my former colleagues at Penn Law School had a chapter in it about the BP oil spill and the Minerals Management Service and all of the problems that were going on with parties on the drilling rig and that sort of stuff. We see it going on right now. Elon Musk had a short and useless tenure with the Trump administration, but obviously he was there in order to enrich Tesla and his own other interests. The new presumptive head of OSHA has experience both at United Parcel Service and Amazon, two of the companies that have done a lot of harm to their workers, so we can only imagine what he wants to do once he's confirmed at OSHA. So yeah, the revolving door is a real thing, goes in both directions. And as I was going to say, up in New Hampshire where I live now, we are a lot of us are engaged in trying to modernize the state's very antiquated system of importing garbage trash from other states and putting it in sound locations. And it turns out now that the New Hampshire Senate, its legal counsel, its only lawyer who advises them on legislation and ethics, is also at the same time representing the Vermont waste company called Casella that is trying to build landfills in the state. And Casella, with this guy as the lead attorney, is suing the state for denying at long last one of their permits. So this one guy is representing the Senate while he is suing the governor. It's a crazy system, but it's allowed by loophole to persist.
It almost speaks of a sort of a fundamental corruption in our system that just won't be solved by, I don't know, sort of willy-nilly reforms or reforms that have a momentum and then, 10 years later they're rescinded by a reactionary regime that comes, be it at the state or federal level.
Right. And look, one of the silver linings, it's a small one, but I'm grabbing onto it, of what's happening now with the federal agencies being demolished, is that it will actually open a door when, again, normal people come back into power who have an interest in society and respect for the rule of law and for government, to rebuild them in ways that could never have been done during the last 50 or 60 years when they were just chugging along and like an aircraft carrier, very, very hard to move. So one of my, I may have talked about this last time, EPA and OSHA were created about a year apart in the early 1970s. And either accidentally or cleverly, they were created at the opposite sides of the DC area, reporting to different congressional committees, different cabinet agencies. They don't work together well. And what that means is that companies who have processes that expose workers to chemicals, and then hours later, when the doors open, expose their communities to chemicals, they never get a chance to sort of work with government and figure out how to solve both problems. They're solving one problem or the other. They're moving the pollution faster into the community, or they're moving it slower and leaving it in the workplace. If we had one agency, presumably things would be more efficient and better for business, but we've never been able to have one. If people come back in 2029 and there is no OSHA and there is no EPA or a shell of those, it could actually be done right.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned, you gave an example of 50 billion plastic bottles being produced every year in order to allow convenient ingestion of water and sodas, et cetera, all to solve the problem of, thirst, et cetera. But given that we're now learning these plastics are now are not only potentially toxic to those ingesting the liquids, but also are themselves breaking down in the environment into hydrocarbon nanoparticles being ingested and metabolized by sea life if it gets into the oceans, including mammals as well as fish and shellfish, which of course are consumed by much of humanity. This is an example, I think, of what economists call external impacts or externalities, in which unaccounted for costs or negative impacts of economic activities and products are not assessed of the private or to the private for-profit corporation, but rather become public burdens, damage to public resources, our environment, and ecosystems. How could solution-focused risk assessment help us with this?
Looking at solutions first allows us to ask different questions. So with the plastic water bottle, EPA for many years has said we have a potential problem here. The problem is with the cleanliness and the safety of the water inside the bottle. So they're looking at endocrine disruptors, at parts per billion, and to their credit, they're saying, here's a chemical called bisphenol A. We want to make the water have less of that. Substitute comes along, bisphenol F. Oh, now we have to lower that. But no one's looking at the simple fact that 50 years ago, zero plastic bottles were produced. None of them went into landfills. None of them used energy to produce them. And now we're up to 50 billion. I think I just looked at the figures, and about 1/500th of all of the energy we use in the US goes into the creation of plastic water bottles. So it allows us to ask the question, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to provide human beings with something they need, not just desire, but they need. But we already knew how to do that. When I was a kid, we had drinking fountains everywhere. And we know how to restore those. We know how to encourage people to have not single-use bottles, but bottles that you can refill. So I'm actually starting to work on a project with some other people looking at products that we have banned or we have evolved beyond in recent years, because we know how to do the same thing safer, cheaper, better. We don't have mercury in thermometers anymore because we know how to make thermometers with alcohol, and we know how to use the digital thermometer on the forehead. We don't let elephants be slaughtered for ivory? We have substitutes for ivory. So why not the plastic water bottle? Why not coal? Why not palm oil? That's ruining a lot of Asian islands with monoculture. I have other examples that might be more traumatic to people, but we have to be willing to ask the question, just because somebody can make something and somebody else can buy it, if there's a better way, why shouldn't we use subsidies, information, taxation, and ultimately regulation to move the market into a place where people can get what they want with fewer of what you rightly called externalities?
Well, to expand on that, I mean the tax on plastic bags that's levied in some jurisdictions, some counties. I think it's county by county in many states. 5 cents per plastic bag that are supposed to be charged by a grocery store.
Well, I think that's a good example because at the state level, they're going further than that. New Jersey, where I live for a few months a year in the winter, has a ban that they don't allow grocery stores to give out single-use plastic bags. So yeah, it took a while. When I come back home in the winter to New Jersey, I have to remind myself that I have to bring a canvas bag to the grocery store. But it's saved money, and people are doing studies. There are far, far fewer plastic bags littering the highway and deposited in landfills and in the oceans where marine life is eating them. So yeah, ultimately, it's something that we figured out. We won't miss. We don't miss typewriters. Typewriters went away because not because of regulation, but because a better product, the personal computer, was developed. But we don't miss them.
Okay. Dr. Finkel, what are your thoughts on the current cynical, I won't even say populist anymore because it's taken on different tones, the current cynical campaign, both legal and political, against your alma mater, Harvard University, by the Trump administration? Harvard has sued and/or countersued. I understand a hearing was held yesterday, and the administration. Is being they're is suing the administration for breach of contract around canceled grants and research funding, as well as attempts to control its governance and policies, with Trump loyalists and defenders of Israel alleging anti-Semitism by student defenders of Palestinian lives and liberties, as well as potentially, going back with, historic anti-Semitism. But that's not what I think they're referring to now. What, in your estimation, are the real threats to Harvard and other higher education institutions posed by Trump's attacks on academic freedom, free speech, research funding, as well as the ability of universities to attract foreign students?
So I think the threats are real. I think in the long run, the threats are going to be more from capitulation by the universities than from successful constraints that are upheld in court, because I think most of these bullying tactics are going to be found to be simply illegal. But Harvard, I think to its credit, is doing more than a lot of other schools to push back. I mean, I think it's because they were singled out unfairly. I don't know if it's whether Trump didn't get in back in the day, or his son didn't get in, but he's got it in for that school. And yes, they're countersuing, and I can't imagine they will lose the case about foreign students. That's just completely arbitrary to punish a university by depriving it of some of the best people who come here and then stay here and then help our country. Some of them go back, but there's nothing wrong with helping their native countries either. Look, I'm a Jewish guy. I have 3 degrees from Harvard. I did not experience anti-Semitism then. It's a long time ago. It could have gotten worse. I experienced worse back in my high school right before that, which was a parochial Episcopalian school. But what's been going on there the last couple of years? There are a few isolated instances of actual violence, threats of violence, disruption of classes, and so forth. By activists for the Palestinian cause, and that should be dealt with as a internal, semi-criminal matter by the school. And I think the school has done, and the other schools have done, by and large, with exceptions, a pretty good job of policing their own problems without treading on free speech. And sometimes occupying a library for a couple hours, I did it with my classmates many, many years ago with South Africa. Is right on the borderline of free speech and campus disruption. But it has the White House should not be swooping down and dealing with this. This is a a problem that should be dealt with on another level. And you said cynical, and don't back off from it. It has nothing to do with protecting Jewish people. Trump is, I believe, an anti-Semite, at least a fanatic. Are you kidding me? Not a friend of the Jews. And it's just such a convenient thing to latch on to. I'm active in the Kennedy School of Government, where I also have a degree, and they just funded with anonymous donors. I believe it's 50 $100,000 scholarships, part stipend and part scholarship, to help people who've been fired from government, both military and civilian, to get advanced degrees at the Kennedy School. And I think that's a great response to the bullying, to say, we're not sitting around and just defending ourselves. We're going to double down and attract more people who believe in government. So I'll finish here, but this is something obviously dear to my heart. I have said to the Kennedy School people, don't be at all embarrassed or shy about what you do. And there's no Che Guevara professorship of at the Harvard Business School. They don't open the door to people who don't believe in capitalism. And I tell my friends and colleagues at the Kennedy School, you should not open your doors to people who don't believe in government. Don't hire them, don't admit them. Have them come and speak and have Q&A, but don't give them an award on the way out. Don't honor Sean Spicer or Corey Lewandowski or Elise Stefanik. They are bomb throwers who don't believe in what we believe in. So viewpoint diversity, screw it. It should be diverse viewpoints within the normal bell curve, not the far right bell curve that is anarchy.
Please explain what you know of the recent announcement by OSHA of a plan to exempt entertainment and sports facilities from workplace safety enforcement. I understand this stems from an OSHA ruling against the company SeaWorld following the death of one of its trainers in an orca tank back in 2010. OSHA issued a ruling that SeaWorld had violated its general duty clause to protect workers against hazards, and prevailed at the Court of Appeals level in 2014. What can you tell us of any recent developments around this issue?
So this is a very weird development. So OSHA has not done a lot in any administration, Democrat or Republican, about the hazards of entertainment and sports. But a few cases like SeaWorld, Broadway shows like Spider-Man, where stunt people were subjected to fall hazards. A little bit in professional football, having to do with heat stroke and not protecting players in practice and in games from excessive heat. But it's never been high on their radar because there's so many manufacturing industries where there are problems occurring in greater number every day. So we were not looking for, in the next 3.5 years, any tremendous enforcement in those areas. But what OSHA has now proposed a couple weeks ago is to forever disclaim any authority to ever regulate or issue citations for hazards in anything that has to do with entertainment and sports. And where it comes from is a just a complete sucking up to Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who at the time was Judge Brett Kavanaugh in the SeaWorld case. So he lost 2-1 in that decision. Merrick Garland, who should have had his Supreme Court seat, was one of the two judges who voted with OSHA. But Brett wrote a dissent. And the dissent was, in my view, not as a lawyer, but as a former law professor, ridiculous. He is supposed to be one of these Republicans who believes in the original intent of Congress. So he calls himself an originalist. And what he said in that really stupid, badly worded, illogical rant of a dissent was, quote, "I can't imagine that Congress did not intend to exempt sports and entertainment when they wrote the 1970 Occupational Safety and Health Act," end quote. So that's the opposite of originalism. He's saying, I'm going to psychoanalyze the Congress of 50 years before. I just can't believe they forgot to say we exempt sports and entertainment. What they did say is anything in commerce, not even manufacturing, commerce, service industries, manufacturing is subject to the Occupational Safety and Health Act. And he comes along and makes something up. And now OSHA put this proposal out saying, using the dissent of Justice Kavanaugh from 10 years ago, we think he was right. And we're going to now give up any claim to being able to enforce standards in entertainment and sport. It's ludicrous, it's craven, and I care about it because I spent a fair amount of time after SeaWorld working with people at the Harvard Law School on the issue of brain disease in professional football and the CTE, the cumulative chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And that's a real thing. We think that maybe 5, 10, 15% of all NFL players will die prematurely with brain disease. And OSHA should be doing something about this, but they're not. But this regulation, this decision, would say they can never do anything about it, and that's a damn shame.
And a sign of a lack of imagination. If he can't imagine it, it sounds like he needs to expand his own intellectual framework. That's
Yeah, well, he was
crazy.
wrestling and having beers, I guess, during the time. But I knew
Certainly.
about him at the time. Watched the confirmation hearings. Could not believe my ears. And he and Gorsuch's kid are now setting about to dismantle the regulatory state, which has done so much good for so many.
That was Professor Adam Finkel speaking about the fight against Trump's assaults on science-based environmental and workplace regulation, Harvard University, and American workers, including those in sports and entertainment. Dr. Finkel recently helped organize a conference of solutions-focused experts. Their website is unpolitics.global. That was Thomas Dolby. She blinded me with science. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. At a recent labor tech conference in San Francisco, Oakland teacher Andy Lisbon talked about the use of artificial intelligence to train teachers. He said that the American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, had initiated a partnership with AI companies like Anthropic and OpenAI, which threatens all teachers, students, and the public.
One of the things that the AFT just decided, Randy Weingarten signed an agreement with OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google to train 100,000 teachers on how to bring AI into the classroom. That is not fighting AI, that is a collaborating with AI. And like all the people have been saying, even though AI is posed as your assistant, folks, you are training your replacement. It is not our assistant, it is our replacement. It's just being trained. If it only knows 10% of your job, it's your assistant. But when it learns 70% of your job, it's going to be your replacement. And this is not just being felt by factory workers, this is going to be felt by people who are so-called mental labor as well, doctors, lawyers, teachers. We're all going to be replaced, and that's the job, and it's profits. The thing I also want to talk about is the other pernicious part of this that people often don't talk about with regards to AI development, and that's in data collection. So has anybody heard of a digital twin? Okay. This is an important term. I was at a conference, just it was a Zoom conference, of people who were having questions about the development of artificial, general artificial intelligence. And these are all tech people, kind of not the top capitalists, but kind of the low-level capitalists who are having startups like Scale Up and things like that. They're like, what are we doing here with AI? And at the end, of, and they were posing, like, maybe this thing could do really damage. Maybe we're leading us to a dystopic future. Like, they were concerned about that. But there are other people who are saying, like, no, this is going to be the greatest thing for healthcare and all that kind of stuff, which it's not, but that's some people believe that. But the end of the presentation, we saw a digital twin of Reid Hoffman. Now, what is a digital twin? A digital twin is all the data that is collected about a person being assembled by an AI and a reconstruction of their personality and image and things like that. So what that meant is Reid Hoffman was there on a YouTube screen. It wasn't Reid Hoffman, it was a creation of Reid Hoffman, speaking in French or German, but basically responding like Reid Hoffman based on all the writings, all the data that had been collected on him. Now here's the thing to know. Digital twins are not just being made of Reid Hoffman, they're being made of all of us. Through how we use our phone, how we use a computer, any keystroke you use, when you erase that keystroke, all of that information is being collected. And to date, it has not been able to be utilized and collected. Like Edward Snowden talked about, collect it all, the NSA and things like that. They have not been able to collect all that data and use it. That is no longer the case. AI can now collect that data and learn from that data, which is what AI development is all about. Now that's going to be important because in addition to knowing that they're going to wipe out our jobs, they know there's going to be a response to this. But if you collect all the data on all the people and basically create digital twins of all of them, you can model, you can game how you can control people in response to whatever's happening. Basically, the AI will play a character of you, an avatar, and decide, here's what you need to see. Here's what your feed needs to be in order to kind of shunt you in a general direction. So the data collection that's happening here is not just about advertising or the things that we talk about like that. It's not just, oh, somebody's making money off the data they're collecting. We're literally training our AI not just to replace us, but to help the government learn how to control us and manipulate us, which this thing called a digital twin. So they're thinking on all ends of this stuff. They know they're bringing in a dangerous thing, and I completely agree with Guido that they're working with powers that could not just destroy the working class, which I don't think they mind that, but may destroy humanity. And I think it is likely will destroy humanity, whether it be through the AI getting over on us because it goes from general intelligence to super intelligence, or the fact that AI is going to be used to monitor Tomahawk missiles going across the Ukraine border. And so the AI in Russia has decided, I'm sorry, we got to let the missiles fly now because that's what has to happen. So all of those things, militarily or socially, are dangerous. And so for me as a teacher, I can see that not only are the teachers union not doing anything about it, but frankly, my colleagues as teachers. I've been outspoken at my school opposed to, I say, I don't use ChatGPT or anything to develop lesson plans. And that's seen as cute, to be honest. Like, well, that's kind of neat. There's one teacher I know who knows I'm in Stop AI and is interested in it. But by and large, teachers complain about students using it for ChatGPT, but they do not understand. And that's only a piece of the threat. The massive threat is us using Google Classroom, us using all these scripted curriculums and things like that, and even us using all these platforms to develop lessons like this that AI can develop for us. Every time we do that, we are training our replacement. And so teachers think this, and it is true, teachers are having a tougher time in the classroom, so they're looking for any shortcut they can do. But this shortcut turns out to be a dead end into ending our jobs. So for me, I'm looking to find other teachers at my site, and I'm working at a Golden State Prep at Aspire. It's a middle school in Oakland. And that's where I think the fight is going to have to be waged at any workplace, which is basically, I'm going to refuse to use AI, I'm going to refuse to use this ed tech stuff, and I'm going to try to get other teachers to do the same. If it's a long road, then I think we are cooked. But I do believe in the short term, those are the sorts of things that teachers are going to have to do. I feel very badly about it. Like I'm scared of it in a way that I didn't know to be scared of it before. Before, I just thought it was irritating that companies were getting over on us and like getting money off of our data. Now I'm like scared that something much more pernicious is at play, and that in the same way that you talked about, like there's living labor of the human that, and we produce dead labor in our tools and things like that. In a sense, our actual identities are being turned into a kind of object outside of ourselves to be used against ourselves. And that's, I think, extremely scary. But it's also, if I was at the top of society and I knew I was going to split if I was going to separate wealth in the way that I'm doing, I would do exactly the same thing they're doing. I mean, I would do it. And that's why I'm like, it makes sense. And it assures control under conditions and under immense misery. It was not fun in 2010. It was not fun in 2020. The next one is going to be worse, right? The next business cycle. And they know that. And they know that they're putting forces in play which are going to make people really pissed. And they're going to keep us, they're going to use data and AI not just as a means of replacing us, but a mechanism of control and nudging. Like, do you want to go this way? Maybe you want to go that way. And that's where your feed will come in, and that's all going to be personalized in the same way that that's how I see it working. On the ground, this is a problem because I want to speak to that part of, for those of us on the ground, in the working class, like, how is this coming? So the first problem is for workers who are totally overworked, being offered this assistant that can maybe cut a few hours off your week of work. I'm asking those people, are you sure this is an assistant or this is a replacement? No. And so they haven't even gotten to that point. If they think it's an assistant and not a replacement, then there's no discussion about stopping it. Then we're done. Like, why discuss, right? But even once they agree it's a replacement, then we get to this debate. Is this a technology that can be used to actually help humanity if we have a revolution? Or is this a technology that must be eradicated, that it's actually a tool that is not neutral, like people think of a hammer as neutral. This is not a neutral tool, but an actual tool that's like, to use religious terms, the devil's work, that is not going to be able to be utilized the way that Luddites saw the textile mills and things like that, the textiles that were coming in. And so that's once we get to the place of saying, okay, we recognize this threat, then I think the next debate, and we haven't gotten there yet, among teachers, our unions are supporting it and teachers are supporting it, overwhelmingly are supporting it. And that means they're going to be supporting the data collection operation that those 100,000, because that's what AI, of students using AI is a data collection operation, to train AI and to make digital twins out of everyone, because they need to know who everyone is, because we're going to be controlling everyone. So if we have to get to the point where people recognize it's an actual threat. The next debate I think we have to have is it a threat in which we can take this tool and use it for purposes of humanity, or is this something that's just going to have to be gotten rid of? I fall on that second side. I'm not saying I'm right, but that's where I'm at. But I think we can all fight it and figure it out along the way, but we're not even there, in my opinion. There's no getting around, it's already been sold. There's no privacy. None of those laws stop any of this stuff from going. PERB, HIPAA, like HIPAA is going to be, doesn't affect your privacy. It's actually a control, HIPAA is actually saying we have the right to collect all that data. Right, so there is no privacy concerns with regards to it. Are they even explained? And in reality, like once we decided to go this way, that phone thing, once we decided to go there, we gave it all up. We have to understand that. Like we don't have any official privacy. How are you feeling today? Right? They give you a little smile meter. How are you feeling today? And then at the end, absolutely, all of them. And at the end, they ask them, how are you feeling now? Because all of that is basically a precursor to wanting them to see how well where you came in your terms of your emotional state. That stuff's going to be partially checked with the facial recognition they do. They say they're feeling sad. We have the facial recognition stuff. We're going to link that to sadness. We're going to be able to then say that whenever we see this person looking that way, because now they have facial recognition, which is on video and things like that, we can predict how that person's feeling. They told us they were feeling this way. We took the snapshot of their picture. That's what they look like when they're feeling that way. And then secondly, once they do the various things, they're going to ask you that question again. Like they want to kind of check those sorts of things. So all of this is not, these computers and programs aren't doing this to do wellness checks. They're doing it to collect data so that they can control us. And that's what we have to understand. It's a military project. It has nothing to do with the well-being of our students or helping us teach. It is a military project. Ultimately really going to be used to make war. That's probably the biggest reuse of it. But under the same conditions, you all have to control the population when you do that. And it has, just leave aside any notion that these companies have anything to do with anything other than profits and control.
That was Oakland teacher Andy Lisman speaking about a partnership between the American Federation of Teachers and tech billionaires like OpenAI owner Sam Altman.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone. Breaking the wall.
Come on, do it again.
All in all, you're just another break in the wall.
We don't need no education.
If you don't need your meat, you can't have any pudding.
We don't need no control.
How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat?
That was Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. There is growing fear and anger over the massive introduction of AI into the government and the workplace. OpenAI, run by Sam Altman, was the target of a protest on July 25th of this year, where workers and philosophers spoke out about why they opposed this technology. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed the participants.
All of our lives are under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
When the lives of people we love are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
My name's Yako. I'm here outside of the OpenAI offices today as part of the Stop AI protest. And they're trying to sell this promise, this vision of AI will help humanity, will save humanity, will make the world a better place. We do not need a super intelligence to make the world a better place. All we need to do is be better humans today. Start taking care of each other today. Rebuild communities. Take care of each other. Stop being so heartless. Stop being so selfish, so greedy. And stop being so afraid of these people with all this power and all this wealth who are trying to intimidate us and scare us and bore us and just make us feel soulless inside. That's all we need to do to make the world a better place. Have a humanity-powered movement today. We don't need some fancy robot or some artificial intelligence to make the world a better place.
Is that the ideology of fascism?
It fundamentally is the ideology of fascism, I think. Yeah, that we need the power consolidated in the hands of a few, that you need to step in line, and everyone needs to be afraid to not speak out, do something different, be creative, to disagree. We should have a society where we can disagree without fear. And they're trying to use this artificial superintelligence and the surveillance state to make us afraid to even disagree anymore.
I do this for a living. I mean, I don't make protest signs for a living. I wish I did. That'd be an awesome living. But I do, I'm a graphic designer and an illustrator. So this is the kind of thing I do all the time anyway, so I'm pretty fast.
And what does it mean to you, AI, as far as work, your job?
Yeah, it means that nobody's going to have a job. And we're just the first, the creatives. We're the canary in the coal mine. But everybody's going to lose their job because that's what they want. My sister was just telling me there's some AI company that said, we're going to replace every job in 5 years. And I'm like, who's like, yeah, great, let's do that. That's going to be great for society. Let's replace everybody's job, you know, and our government's so generous. I'm sure the UBI would just be over the top. So. Yeah.
So what's going to stop it? Because they would argue, well, technology, you can't stop technology.
The people. The people have to stop it. We have to have everybody against it. I mean, how many people really genuinely enjoy and want AI? Most people hate it. And like, look at like customer service, right? Every customer service now is a chat bot, and they're absolutely useless. So that's one way that corporations just like lock you out from any information. They'll take your money, but they're not going to put any money into helping you. So it's just, it's just overall
a bummer. The system is based on private ownership It's based on these people, these billionaires running things, and apparently now they directly control the government, all these tech billionaires. Thiel, David Sachs, Peter Thiel, they're now in charge of the government. Are you afraid of what's coming?
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, once you drew the line from the Trump organization to all these tech guys, oligarchs, it's like there's fascism wrapped up in a little bow. And yeah, I'm totally worried. And I think that the only thing that will overcome AI is if the people decide, no, I'm not going to use it. I don't want it. Like if I'm working with a company and I see that they've incorporated AI, and a lot of them do it just to look cool, I don't work with them anymore.
Emil Torres.
You are not a scientist?
A philosopher.
Even if one is skeptical about the truth of what you're saying, even if one thinks that OpenAI is not on the verge, as they claim, of developing superintelligent machines in the coming years, it is still extremely alarming to hear an individual who has billions of dollars running a company that is backed by tens of billions of dollars, supported by, funded by Microsoft and so on, make these claims, right? Most people, in most other situations, if somebody said, I'm up to something that might kill everyone in my neighborhood. Even if you think that they're a little bit nutty, that's still just a really alarming and unacceptable thing for someone to utter. So this is one reason I'm out here, but there's also, I think it's worth not losing sight of the fact that there is a multiplicity of different issues, problems associated with AI, from environmental degradation, the amount of fresh water that the data centers use up, algorithmic bias, the perpetuation, propagation of stereotypes. There is massive intellectual property theft. I published with an academic publishing company called Routledge, which made a deal without my consent, without the consent of any of its authors, to sell the books that they published to Microsoft so that OpenAI can train their models on my intellectual labor. Right? I had no say in that. There's no consent, there's no compensation. So that's another issue that greatly concerns me. And then, of course, worker exploitation, right? So there was this article that was published in Time magazine a couple years ago, I think it was 2023, that found that OpenAI had hired a company that was paying workers in Kenya as low as $1.32 an hour to basically sift through like material that constitutes the most extreme stuff you might ever find online. So like CSAM, descriptions of sexual assault and things of this sort. So these are individuals who are marginalized, who are disempowered or in unfortunate circumstances, getting paid almost nothing to basically get PTSD, right? And some of these individuals, their lives sort of fell apart. And they're basically just no consequences for that. OpenAI has not faced any consequences at all, neither has Sam Altman. And, in the meantime, they're, to the contrary, I mean, they're rushing to build increasingly large language models. Microsoft just bought three reactors at Three Mile Island. So they understand that the amount of energy they need is enormously large, right? And in fact, Microsoft's carbon footprint, I think, has increased by something like 20% in the past few years. I think Google's has increased by something like 40-some percent since 2019. And that's entirely because of the large language models that these individuals believe are the stepping stones that are going to lead us to artificial general intelligence, AGI. And the whole reason they want AGI in the first place is to create this utterly bizarre fantasy of replacing the biological world with a new digital world, right? Altman himself has signed up with a company called Nectome to have his brain preserved if he dies prematurely, so that it can be digitized and uploaded to the cloud. And he said in an article for the MIT Technology Review that he thinks this will be possible in his lifetime. So the whole vision here is to create these increasingly powerful AI systems. Because once you have superintelligence, then you have a means for realizing this utterly strange technutopian vision that none of us have consented to. None of us have been, our opinions have never been solicited by these individuals. So it's another way to put it is that the future that they're working towards through the development of these advanced technologies is deeply, deeply undemocratic. And not inclusive, right? If it were democratic and inclusive, they would be, companies like this would be actually, questioning people. I'll put it differently, showing some curiosity in what it is that the rest of humanity once out of the future. And I'll mention one last quote from Altman, who was talking about how the board of OpenAI is needs to include individuals who represent people from all around the world, different cultures, different nations, different peoples, etc. Because, in his words, and I'm quoting, because if I were in on this, I'd be like, why do these fuckers get to say what my future is going to be? Right? Those were his words. So that's why he's recognizing the undemocratic nature of the race to build AGI right now. What did OpenAI do? Well, then they went on to completely fail to represent people from all around the world. And instead, their board represents very, very narrow interests, a very small portion of the human population. And so for all these reasons, it's just a deeply elitist and enormously problematic world that they're trying to create through the development of these technologies. So on the one hand, the idea of utopia, I think, is deeply flawed. On the other hand, the push, the path, the journey towards utopia is causing all sorts of harms in the present. Environmental degradation, worker exploitation, and so on. So those are my two big issues with the ongoing race to build AGI with OpenAI here, and that's why I came out to check out this protest. Yeah, so I published a book with Routledge last year, and then found out that Microsoft had made a deal with Routledge so that OpenAI could train their systems on my intellectual labor. So there's no compensation, there was no consent. So this harms me personally, but even just impersonally, the whole situation is just completely unacceptable because for really all the reasons that I enumerated a moment ago.
So they have the right to take your intellectual property?
Legally, yes. Right now, yeah. So
so that's a threat to all intellectuals, all artists?
Absolutely. So I think on the one hand, they're training their material on... they're training their systems on material that they haven't acquired legally. That's precisely why the New York Times has taken OpenAI to court, right? And why all of these other artists and writers are suing OpenAI. In my particular case, they're using my labor, my writing, in a legal way, right? But even if it's legal, that doesn't mean it's moral, right? So I would object from an ethical perspective. And say that no, if there's a company that's going to rake in billions and billions of dollars, and Sam Altman himself is a billionaire with huge mansion in Hawaii or whatever, but yet the reason he has all this money is because he's exploiting me. There's something like deeply unfair and unjust. So, yes, in many ways, this whole thing, this whole endeavor involving AI is techno-capitalism on steroids, right? I mentioned the utopian vision. That could be understood as techno-capitalism on steroids in precisely that way.
And they control the state.
Yeah, and so ultimately in this utopian vision, it's not just about like extracting and exploiting and plundering all of the resources on Earth. It doesn't stop there. No, you need to go out and colonize space. Altman himself has said, without AGI, space colonization is likely impossible. Right, so he is well aware of this ultimate goal, that if we're going to go out and colonize space and plunder the cosmos and conquer the universe, right, we're going to need these super intelligent AI systems. In fact, we're probably not even going to be able to spread beyond our solar system if we aren't digital beings, or if we haven't just passed off the baton to some successor species that is digital in nature.
Those were the voices of community activists and workers in San Francisco protesting the introduction of AI into the workplace and the power of tech baron Sam Altman, who runs OpenAI. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from myself, Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Zeltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.